in politics, we see the most polarized and the most polarizing, but they do not stand for a whole group. Because in society, in our lives with people, we cannot afford to be like that. We need cooperation.
Välkommen till Tysklandspodden, en podcast av Goethe-institutet i Sverige. Vi bjuder in spännande gäster för att prata om kultur, samhälle och mycket mer. Och här kan du lära känna helt nya sidor av Tyskland. Jag heter Sonja Leister och jobbar på Goethe-institutet med litteraturprogrammet och biblioteket. Tonläget är väldigt hårt i den offentliga debatten, särskilt nu under valrörelsen i Sverige. Och när jag öppnar tidningen eller kollar Instagram så känns det som att politiker, debattörer, aktivister, alla skriker mest på varandra. Och det gäller framförallt i de ganska laddade frågorna såklart som klimat, migration eller Mellanöstern. Och därför ska vi i detta avsnitt djupdyka i temat polarisering. Varför är debatten idag så uppskruvad? Vem tjänar på det? Och vad gör det med vår demokrati? Och såklart, vad kan jag eller du som lyssnar göra emot det? Med oss har vi idag den tyska journalisten och författaren Gilda Zahebi som bor i Berlin och hon skriver om rasism, demokrati och Mellanöstern. Hennes senaste bok är en fackbok med titeln Verbinden statt Spalten. Det kan man översätta till att förena istället för att splittra. Hi and welcome to the studio here in Stockholm, Gilda Zahebi.
Hi Sonja, nice to be here, thank you.
If you were allowed to use only one adjective, how would you describe the public debate in Germany right now?
Frustrating.
Can you develop that more then?
I think that public debate in Germany, as well as in many other Western democracies, has gone far away from what people are dealing with in their daily lives. I think it's not a mirror of reality in many ways. It shows a kind of split, a kind of being good and bad, enemy or friend, which is not the reality of people.
Maybe it's good if we start with a definition. When we say polarization, what does this word actually mean?
Yes, I think that's important because in the book I talk about affective polarization, which is kind of an emotional polarization. It's not about polarization per se, where you say we have different ideas, different thoughts, different concepts for policies, society, economy. We need different concepts and we need different ideas. We need polarization in that sense, and a lot of it. We need to have arguments about what is the best way out of crisis, what is the best way to give people, everyone, a good life. We need these different concepts. Affective polarization is a whole different ballgame. It means basically to make people believe that they are in certain groups, maybe left or right or woke or not woke. So affective polarization says my group is better than yours and I hate your group or I detest your group. I don't like your group. You're the bad group. I'm in the good group. That's affective polarization. And unfortunately, when we look at the political, also media debate, we believe that there is like this one group that has one opinion and the other group that has another opinion. But that's not true. It's not true. But it gets stronger the more we do talk about this very emotional subjects, like, for instance, gender, trans, whatever. Everything that to some people, not to all of them and not to the majority, but to some people is like very core to their identity. Data in Germany shows us that, of course, they're like polarized people, but the majority of people is somewhere in between. Sometimes they feel this way, sometimes they feel the other way, and most of all, they don't hate people for feeling differently. But in media and politics, we usually see these two sides of very polarized people. You can see that in the whole Gaza-Israel issue debate. You see very strong pro-Israel people on TV or wherever, or on X, and you see very strong pro-Palestinian. But people who are like, I'm not really sure what to think, or I have doubts, or I understand them, but I also understand them. You don't see those people, but there are a lot of them.
I find that very interesting, because you say it's good that we have opposites and that we have discussions and different concepts. So polarization per se in politics, to have very different opinions, is not the issue. The issue is when you start to like almost hate or look down on your political opponents, when you think this person is not as good as I am because he or she has the wrong opinion. Do I get that correctly?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Because what you say, I think the example with Israel and Palestine is good, but there are, of course, many more. Because when I talk to people in my my colleagues or friends or people I meet somewhere, I always get the impression that people have quite a moderate view on a lot of things. For example, this conflict in the Middle East. I know very few hardliners, but when I look at the debate in social media or media, it is a whole different topic. It's like there are only extremes. Why is it like that? Why is the debate so different from the real debate?
Well, there's studies on that from the United States, where they have been doing studies on polarization way longer than we have in Germany. In Germany, we're just getting started, which is good. We need more data on polarization. And in those studies, they've discovered that the more someone is active, engaged in politics, media, civil society, the more polarized they are. We see these people. That's the people that we see and hear about. We do not see other people who are not in media or in politics. And so there's this wrong image where, I don't know, very polarizing person in Sweden, but if you think of someone super polarizing, on which side ever, doesn't matter, Greta Thunberg, for instance, okay? Then what happens is she is seen as the representative for a whole group of people. For instance, climate activists. That's not true. Whatever you think of Greta Thunberg, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. But people project onto other people what they see in her. And then they think, okay, if I see another climate activist or someone maybe, or someone who likes Greta Thunberg, for even that, then it's like, oh, you must be just like her. Mm. That's not true. Because in media, in politics, we see the most polarized and the most polarizing. But they do not stand for a whole group. Because in society, in our lives with people, we cannot afford to be like that. We need cooperation. We need help. We need to support one another. We can't survive otherwise. The way the dynamics work in politics and media is very, very, very different. There, it's mostly about two things: wanting to be right and blaming others. We can't function that way. Imagine being like this for a week in your life, always blaming others, always wanting to be right. You're not going to have a lot of friends left after that. Rightly so. That's not a good thing to do, because it shatters any kind of relationship, because it doesn't work that way. Mm. So the dynamic in the political and media system is different because of two things: power and money. Because when you, and attention also, because if you are polarizing, I mean, look at Donald Trump. He has understood how to do it. He really has. And he's done it to the maximum extent. So far that he's president because of that. Because he says there is a bad group, the left, the migrants, the whatever, and me. And I'm the good one.
You talk a lot about polarization entrepreneurs in your book who use polarization for their own gain, or the effective polarization. But who are these people? Who are those entrepreneurs?
That term is from Steffen Mau. He's a German sociologist. He made up that term, which I think is very fitting. That's why I use it in my book, because they make profit out of it. I mean, look at Elon Musk. He there are estimates that he made profit with him helping Donald Trump in his presidential campaign of, I think, $85 billion. That's a lot of money. Because why? He used X and he changed the algorithms on X, the social platform, where polarizing posts get way more attention than those that are not. I left X quite a long time ago because it doesn't make sense to write there or communicate, because it's only about good and bad. Also, Donald Trump, he would not have become president, and definitely not twice, if he hadn't, like in 2015, when he came down that golden escalator in Trump Tower and said, "I want to be president." He talked about two things: the bad immigrants, you know, the Mexicans, they're rapists, and the bad rest of the world, and that's why we need tariffs. Like, he's had that idea for a long time. There is no other way that he won. And then you have circumstances, economic ones, that help these authoritarian parties. And that's why what I make very clear in my book, that polarization is only good for authoritarians. It always only helps authoritarians to rise to power, because they have nothing else. They don't have good policies. They don't have good ideas. They don't want everyone in a society to be in a good place, to be safe, to be nourished, to live in dignity. They don't want that. They don't care. They only want money and power for themselves. So all they do have is polarization.
The thing is, you have named Trump, you have named Elon Musk, but if we think about Germany, if we think about Sweden, we have also a lot of politicians from democratic parties. Yes. or activists who are Democrats, but they are still in this sphere, and they still can use very polarizing language. And why is that happening? Because it's not only those extremists who are part of polarization.
That's super important, because that's the actual problem. That's why I said polarization only serves authoritarians, but it's not only used by them, and that's a problem. Daniel Ziblatt, he's a political scientist at Harvard. He wrote the book How Democracies Die in 2018. That's a very well-known book. And he said a couple of years ago, he said in every society, there are about 25 to 30% of crisis of people who are gonna have a tendency to want the authoritarian path. Like, they say, we need authoritarian structures, we need a leader, la la la.
So this is a given in every society?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay, 25 to 30%.
Yes, it can be lower, mm-hmm. It can be a bit higher, I guess, but probably not really higher.
Somewhere around there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he says the problem happens when you have democratic politicians who, in order to gain power, to have jobs, to have ministerial jobs, whatever, they link themselves to authoritarian politicians. They take over their methods, they go into coalitions with them, and that is the big mistake. That is where all the danger comes from. Because you have 70%, 70, 75, maybe 80% of people who want to live in a liberal democracy that makes it possible for them to have a good life. But you don't do those people right if you say, because I want to be rich and famous, basically, I'm saying it in a polemic way a little bit, I'm going to do politics the way authoritarians do politics.
Mm.
And we're seeing that a lot. We see that with the Republican Party in the US. We see that with the Conservative and also the Social Democratic Party in Germany. And I think also in Sweden.
Maybe the problem is when you have populist parties rising in any country, like also Sweden or Germany, maybe the other politicians feel that they are under a huge amount of pressure, because they see how they gain votes, how a lot of voters find their narratives attractive, their policies attractive, and somehow the others might feel that they have to do the same to compete. What do you say to them?
Same thing I just said. More people don't want that. Also, I don't call them populist parties. There's this criticism in social science for the term populist, because for one thing, it claims that they're saying what the people want, which is not true. And also it covers things that they actually are. They are racist, they are anti-social, they're like all kinds of things. And it's better to call them what they are instead of populist. And we have many, many studies that show if you repeat the same narratives of the authoritarian parties, you're going to strengthen them. We know that. It's all like I have a podcast also, and I feel like every week we ask this question, why in the world are they doing this? Because we know from studies, from evidence, we've seen it. We've seen it in the US, we've seen it in Denmark, we've seen it in all kinds of places. It's not working.
One thing that really stood out to me when I read your book was the gap between what people actually think and what we assume others think. This was really mind-blowing for me. So could you please now explain also a little bit this difference between the so-called perceived group opinion and people's real opinion? How does that look like?
Well, there are also studies on that. It has to do with many things, but one of the things it has to do with is a psychological phenomenon where when other people do something bad, we believe they're just bad people. It's just a bad person. When we do something bad, we're like, well, I had my reasons. You know, the context, circumstances, all
you
of
you are complex.
Yes, I'm complex, others are not.
Okay.
That's not true, obviously. Obviously, if I am a very complex human being, probably everyone else is also. Or most. Not everyone, Donald Trump's not that complex, but
I think he is in his way.
In his way. But most people are just as complex as I am. And so it's easy to assume that there is this whole group of people who want bad things for my country or for my society. No, it's not true. It's also called pluralistic ignorance, this phenomenon. You can measure it basically by doing a kind of study where you ask a representative group, you give them like statements, and then you ask them, do you agree with the statement? And how many people in German society, in Swedish society, whatever, agree. And for instance, a statement that Stefan Mau used in this study was, immigrants that live in Germany and are willing to work should get the same social welfare that Germans do. When you ask that question to people, most people agree. So the second question, so how many people do you think agree? Stefan Mau found the number of 45%. So people believe 45% on average in a society believe that to be true. Yes, they agree. They should get the same welfare. But in reality, it's 88.8%. So the huge majority of people. Of course, there are different numbers. Some are lower. Sometimes the gap is smaller. But it's almost always there.
Yeah, I found that so interesting because I read this statement and these numbers in your book, and I was shocked in a very positive way that it's almost 89% who seem to agree on that. And I think this really did something to me, that I realized, oh my God, maybe I think so much less of the people around me than I should.
Yes.
Is there more of these examples? Because I find that quite interesting.
There are many studies on that, all kinds of polarization studies. I mean, for instance, the US is way more polarized, emotionally polarized, than Germany or Sweden. And even then, even there, when you ask about abortion, a huge majority of people in the US think it should be legal, although it's so highly polarized. Huge majority in Germany thinks it should be legal in the first 3 months. But when you listen to the debate, you would think, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Everyone hates one another.
Yeah.
But it's just not true. And we have that from all kinds of data that we have. Also, just thinking about it, it would be so weird if people were as bad as we believe that they are. We wouldn't have societies that work so well. our societies work really, really well. We support each other and we don't ask first, who do you vote for?
Now, we've talked a lot about the debate in Germany, and maybe you who are listening are now more curious about German news. So I just wanted to mention that the Goethe-Institut offers a global e-library called Onleihe. And this digital library, you can rent German ebooks, of course, but also Germany's most read magazines and newspapers. So, for example, you can read Die Zeit or Süddeutsche Zeitung, and you will find a link to the e-library Onleihe on our website, and we will post the link in our show notes for today's episode too. We've touched upon that a little bit already, that there is this division or this split or divide in the debate, a narrative of us against them. And you elaborate on that a lot in your book. Could you give us a few examples of those?
One of the strongest one, of course, we've mentioned is the us against them in the terms of ethnic division. So
migrants against migrants, majority.
Exactly. Yeah. Non-white against white. So that's basically one of the strongest ones. The ones that have become very prominent in the last few years are the whole culture wars issues. Also us against them. So woke has become a very important term. When you say woke, all kinds of associations come with that. Like, I don't know. Basically, they're queer and they drink almond milk.
They're vegan.
Vegan, anti-Semitic, well, all kinds of things. When you say right or conservative, also again, they must be racist, they must be sexist, they must have an SUV. There's this interesting study also from the US. They did the study where they asked people what they believe of Republican voters and of Democratic voters. So they asked them, how many percent of Democratic voters do you believe are part of the LGBTIQ community? Mm-hmm. And the average of the answer was 36%, which is crazy. The actual number is 6%. Then they asked, how many of the Republican voters do you think earn more than $250,000 a year? The answer again was something like 34%. 34%. The real answer is 2%. But these are the ideas that we have of this one political group that we believe that's how they are.
We have prejudice against them.
Yeah. And so, but it has to do with the culture war issue, right? They must be trans, they must be gay, they must be bi, or the other ones, they must be rich. No, it's not true. Then I have a whole chapter on the whole economic issue, where it's the deserving versus the undeserving. So the deserving are the ones that work hard every day. They go to work every morning. They feed their families and they pay their taxes. And the undeserving are those who don't get up in the morning and they just stay home and they get social welfare and la la la. Also not true. It does not work that way. Because the idea behind this narrative is, behind the story, is that if you give everything that you have, then you're going to make it. That's crazy. It's not true at all. Like, the data shows everything but that. It doesn't, like, the American dream is not real. But it's told.
People cannot climb the ladder in reality, the social ladder.
No. There are people who do. It's the absolute exception. And then they are shown as an example for everyone else. If you're still like washing dishes in a restaurant, it's your own fault. You're not working hard enough.
Yeah, that is this Protestant work ethic that's also very prominent in Sweden, of course, or Germany, Christian background.
Yes. A single mom who has two children, who gets up every morning at 6 to work her job and then maybe work the next job, is she just not working hard enough because she's hardly making any money? No. Because in this story, you just put aside all the structural issues. But you have this image of the undeserving, oh, they're just laying on the couch all day, lazy and not doing anything, where you can project all of that onto. These people hardly exist. Hardly. There's some of them, yes. It's not even like maybe 1% of people get welfare. Because everyone, most people do want to be part of a social group. They want to make their own money. But we keep talking about these undeserving, and politics uses this image of those people in order to cut welfare, to cut social services and all of that.
If we stay a little bit in the Swedish context, you're currently visiting Sweden. You sit here in the studio or my office in Stockholm.
Very lovely.
Yeah, thanks. Where we pre-record this interview. And yesterday you took part in a talk here at the Goethe Institute and discussed polarization with a Swedish political commentator and political scientist Lisa Pelling. What is your impression after that? Do you see any similarities, any differences between the two countries when it comes to polarization?
I see a lot of similarities. I see what makes it for me, what can I say, even harder to watch in Sweden is that fundamentally it is a country of social cohesion. It's always been this example, this good example for us in Germany, but surely on all of Europe, or even in the world, as a country where people really, really stick together. And I think the high numbers of migration in 2015 and 16 have been used to shatter this. And I think that's really, really sad. And the instrument, the tool is polarization. And that's how the Sweden Democrats have become stronger, also an authoritarian party. From what I understand, other democratic parties are informally working with them, and an authoritarian party in power, we saw that in Hungary, always means polarization, and it drives people apart. And I don't know, like I really hope that Sweden does not go that way any further. I think this has always been the strength of this country. I have family here. It's not far from Germany. I've been watching Swedish politics for a long time. I'm just saying, like, there is still a very communal feeling of bringing children up together, of helping each other, of social welfare being something good, not something bad, which is a crazy thing to think that it's bad. So I hope that this process doesn't go on, but it doesn't look good, I think.
This permanent confrontation in the public debate is not just exhausting. As you said, it can also become very dangerous for democracies. And I know there are a lot of structural problems here that are difficult to save for you and me and people listening. But I think there's still also a personal responsibility for everyone to think about all this and to wonder, what can I do to contribute to a better debate culture? So do you have one or two concrete tips for me and for the listeners? What can we do?
So I think, I mean, there's the individual level and there's the structural level. On the individual level, if I don't want to participate in polarization, I have to start with myself. That's just how it is. I have to look at, where am I polarized? Where do I think I'm part of the moral group? I'm part of the better group. My group is better than theirs. Then it's going to be harder for political media dynamics to get me. Also, maybe I will be able to talk to people I don't want to talk to, or to try to understand people I maybe wouldn't have understood. And again, understanding does not mean condoning. But I know that polarization in Germany is going through a lot of families. I can imagine it's the same here. Family is something that you usually want to preserve. So maybe try to look at your own polarization and then don't judge others for that. And try to talk to them. Try to listen. Listening is a skill. Listening is not something that's given. You need to practice listening without judging, without wanting to convince the other person that you're right. Because that's not a conversation. Conversation is listening. It's not going in and saying, well, I'm going to explain to you why I am right And at the end of this conversation, I want you to think the way that I think. That's not what that is. On the structural level, there's all kinds of things, you know, civil society in Sweden as well as in Germany, in the US and all kinds of places. That's what gives me hope. Because there's so many people that are being engaged, active. They're trying to make their communities better. They get together. They organize demonstrations. They help people in poverty. They teach children, like all kinds of things. It's incredible, the energy coming out of people. Because politics is letting them down. It is. It really is. In Sweden as well as Germany. And I don't see people who are like depressed about it. I see people who do a lot about it. And I think that's something that we need to make bigger.
Thank you so much, Gilda Sahebi, journalist and author of the book Verbinden statt Spalten, that I highly recommend. And thank you for helping us understand more about polarization.
Thank you so much for having me and for this talk.
Jag heter Sonja Leistet. Tack för att du har lyssnat på Tysklandspodden. Om du gillade avsnittet, följ oss gärna i din podcast-app så missar du inget nytt avsnitt. Nu tar vi en paus och kommer tillbaka efter sommaren med ett nytt avsnitt. Tysklandspodden är en podcast av Goethe-institutet i Sverige. Produktion och redaktion Ylva Ratjen, Judith Mirschberger och Sonja Leister. Vi hörs snart.